This is Dean Tuo, author of Subscribed, Why the Subscription Model Will Be Your Company's Future and What to Do About It. And you are listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, where each week I publish an interview with the author of a new marketing or sales book, and which was named by Forbes as one of 11 smart podcasts that will keep you in the know. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas in order to succeed in the quickly changing field of modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything linkable in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And since you're a listener to the Marketing Book Podcast, if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or some other helpful resource that I know of for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. Also, I'd like to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. Blinkist is an app that takes the key insights from the best nonfiction books and distills them into a format that you can read or listen to in just 15 minutes on your smartphone. Several of the books featured on the Marketing Book Podcast are on Blinkist. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer for Marketing Book Podcast listeners where you can sign up for free at Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast. Blinkist is spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, and if you opt for the paid version, you'll get an additional 20% off, but only if you go to Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And now, on with the show. Today, we welcome Tien Tzuo to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about the book he's authored with Gabe Weissert, Subscribed, Why the Subscription Model Will Be Your Company's Future and What to Do About It. Tien Tzuo is the founder and CEO of Zuora, the leading subscription economy software as a service provider with more than 1,000 customers worldwide. He was formerly the chief marketing officer and chief strategy officer of Salesforce, where he was employee number 11. And, interesting fact, he was born in Taiwan, the Republic of China, and immigrated to the U.S. when he was 3 years old with his family and moved to the Flatbush section of Brooklyn. Tien, congratulations Hi. On Subscribed and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks, Doug. It's great to be here.
So I watched several TV interviews you've done and keynotes you've delivered. And Tien, to my disappointment, I cannot detect a Brooklyn accent.
Yeah, you know, I've been in California for over 20 years, and so it gets washed away sometimes. I think I have to actually be back in Brooklyn where it comes out.
Okay.
I am told that when I say the word Brooklyn, the Brooklyn accent comes out. So.
Okay. Don't forget the folks back home. So
that's right.
I have to say, careful listeners to the Marketing Book Podcast will know that there have been more authors on the podcast with Stanford degrees than from any other school. And when you're the host of the Marketing Book Podcast, you keep track of trivia like that. So you have a degree from Stanford, as does Gabe Weissert. Yeah. And there's something going on here where it's like they're cornering the market on this podcast. And actually, two other books related to the topic of yours and which were mentioned in your book that have been on this podcast, Robbie Kelman-Baxter's The Membership Economy sure. and Ann Janzer's sure. Subscription Marketing.
Great authors.
The great authors. And you know what else?
What else?
Both have Stanford
Both
degrees.
Both Stanford, yeah.
So it's like, wait a minute, what's going on here? So I guess if any other, clearly Stanford makes you sign something if you go to the School of Business there or whatever, that you are going to write a marketing or a sales book. And interestingly, I mentioned Salesforce and you were employee number 11. Now, again, another bit of trivia that you may find interesting. I recently interviewed Guy Kawasaki about his book, A Wise Guy.
Yeah.
And he has a Stanford degree, of course. There's clearly, oh man, I hadn't realized that. And he talked about when he worked at Apple, one summer he hired a USC student intern. And he said the kid was slightly pushy and obnoxious and, you know, a little
I know where this is going.
And he was from Hillsboro, California. So they called him the Hillsboro Doughboy. And that student, you know this, was Marc Benioff, founder of Salesforce.
He interned at Apple for a couple of years, yeah, working for Guy.
Yeah, and I heard somewhere that you interviewed for your job with Salesforce at Mark's apartment. Is that true?
Well, it was so early. It was still in stealth mode officially, even though I discovered them because Don Clark of the Wall Street Journal actually wrote a column about Salesforce. Sent my resume into cool jobs at Salesforce.com, and they're like, come for an interview. And because there was no offices yet, my interview was in Mark's house.
That's exactly right. Were you wondering what you were getting into by going to his house or his apartment?
I mean, people were working there, so it's technically it was two houses, but the engineers were there coding away.
Okay.
The non-developers were there trying to do some business development deals or jump the first few customers, right? Whatever we were doing back then. But it sounds maybe foreign to people outside of Silicon Valley, but it's definitely part of the Silicon Valley dream, right? The idea of, you know, starting a company out of your garage.
Uh-huh.
Right. And so this definitely had that feel to it. And there was a romance to it. And it certainly pulled me in.
Yeah, that's an exciting story. And I have to guess that when you were working for Mark Benioff, you never referred to him as the Hillsborough Doughboy.
I will have to. Yeah, no, absolutely not. That would not be a good idea.
Okay, good. Well, let me just say that this book is extremely well written. And as I sometimes say to authors, it's actually almost written better than it had to be because it really was a joy to read. A lot of personality.
Oh, good. And thanks for saying that.
You explain things, some rather complicated things for people that might be new to the subscription model, extremely well. But I just want to read one excerpt from the very beginning.
Sure.
And we'll go from there. You write, a couple of years ago, I wrote an article for Fortune magazine advising people not to go to business school.
Oh, you're getting me in trouble. Look at that. So much for the Stanford thing.
Yeah.
Now I see where it's going.
I argued that it was a waste of time, that for the past 100 years, business schools basically taught one idea. The fundamental goal of every business is to create a hit product and then sell as many units of that product as possible, thereby diluting fixed costs in order to compete on margins. I said that this model was over, that the situation has changed. Instead, I argued the goal of the business should be to start with the wants and needs of a particular customer base, then create a service that delivers ongoing value to those customers. The idea was to turn customers into subscribers in order to develop recurring revenue. I called the context for this change the subscription economy. And then the very next line you write, oh man, did I get a lot of crap for that article. What was the reaction?
Well, it was genuine, right? So imagine, you know, I got my Stanford Business School degree in 98, started Salesforce in 99. And just that contrast, the contrast between coming out of business school with all these concepts of how do you go to market? How do you gather requirements from customers? How do you look at the income statements? And you're sitting at Salesforce and you're realizing that what we do is not selling a product. What we do is providing a service. And we had to throw all those techniques out the door and really restart from basic assumptions of what it means to build a business. And so it was sincere. You just sort of pull back and say, you know, everything about business school, again, how you market, how you sell is based on the premise of selling product. And that's just not what we do. And so, yeah, I still go back to Stanford, right? Stanford is here in Silicon Valley. It's a great place for entrepreneurism. I go back every year to help do one of the classes. And it's been great to see the student body evolve over the years. And obviously, it's a great institution. But we just wanted to draw out the contrast to show that this new business model called the subscription-based business model truly is a different business model. And it does force you to rethink companies from basic principles.
Mm-hmm. So back then, and probably even now, you must feel like Copernicus explaining to people that the Earth rotates around the sun rather than the sun around the Earth. So explain what you mean. You write that when you finally discover your customers, it changes everything about your company. How so?
Well, I'll bring it back to the moment, right? In some ways, the reason we wrote this book was if you simplify the Salesforce experience, obviously, if you're in the software industry, you know that there's a whole new way of delivering software, right? Using technology such as cloud computing, the internet, right? You know, right. Browsers and stuff like that. But side by side with that was a whole different business model. And so if you simplify Salesforce down, it was trying to figure out what this new business model really meant, right? What does it mean to run software as a service versus selling software as a product? And what inspired us to start my new company, Zora, and ultimately write the book based on experiences both at Salesforce and working with other companies, is realizing that this business model is not a software phenomenon, but it can apply to really any business. And ultimately, that's why we wrote the book. And I'll bring it back to a moment that we had in the early days of Salesforce, where, you know, we all came from software companies where we shipped the software and our customers would install it. And you would not exactly know what the customers are doing, right? Because it's in their offices, it's in their homes. But since we were online, right, they were accessing our servers, we can actually see, do they log in? Do they use this feature? How many reports do they run? How many contacts do they run? How many clicks did it take them to do basic operations? And it was fascinating for us, right? Because all of a sudden, we can actually see how our products were being physically used. And it changes everything about how you think. Right? It changes like, well, you know, instead of throwing out a big feature out there, why don't we trickle our product out, watch how people are using it, and then iterate really, really quickly. Right? This part of the product wasn't designed very well. Let's go fix it. Well, we thought this part of the product was really cool, but no one's actually using it. Right? You know, why not? What did we assume wrong? And so you can engage your customers with that process. Now, fast forward, we're 2018, 2019. And, you know, there's this movement out there called, you know, the Internet of Things. And what that means is all these products, these physical products, are having sensors in them, collecting data and putting it into the internet. And so now the washing machine comes connected. You know, if you buy a washing machine now, it's probably connected to your Wi-Fi. You could probably, you know, access it from your phone. You could do that for your cars. You could do that for major tractors. You could do that for planes. You could do that for all the security equipment or all the heating equipment inside, you know, inside commercial buildings. And so every single physical product manufacturer is having the same experience that we had at Salesforce.com. And it's just mind-blowing. Imagine the engineers building a tractor that releases it into the marketplace and all of a sudden can see how are my customers actually using these products, right? And then bring that back into their product development cycle. It just changes everything. And then the business model slowly follows from that. If I'm going to go ahead and iterate on my product, I really need to have a long-term relationship with my customers. And the amount they should pay me, one, should be on an ongoing basis, right, as a reflection of the service. And then two, should be based on the way they're using the products. How deeply are they using? How much are they using? And so you become a service company, right? You start to look like more of a telephone company providing, you know, telephone service or data access services than a washing machine company selling washing machines. And that's the leap that companies are going through.
Right. So you've already explained that this is not just some Silicon Valley phenomenon of just being used by software as a service companies.
Yeah, that's right.
So let's talk about some other things. I think that people may not realize that it's gone way beyond just software. Let's zero in a bit more on one of the most important concepts from the book is that the deeper relationship and understanding you have as your customer, the better your product can be, the faster it's going to grow, the competitive advantage is going to be there. So can you explain the concept of companies that are suffering because they're, as you say, selling their products to total strangers, like an automobile manufacturer?
Well, we take it back to why do companies exist as they exist, right? And it goes back to probably early 20th century, late 19th century, when companies figured out that it's all about scale, right? And so if I can scale up with assembly lines, mass manufacturing, mass production, whatever it is, then I can, you know, basically amortize my biggest fixed costs. I could buy the most number of, you know, trucks in my fleet, the most number of stores, the biggest factories. I can spread those costs over as many units as I can. And that's how I bring my costs down and I can sell those products. And that's how I win in the marketplace, right? So you get things like any color you want, as long as it's black.
You talk about the tyranny of the margin.
The tyranny of the margin, right? And because it's all about getting that margin down so you can actually win in the marketplace. And so you can't have any color. It's got to be black. And by the way, why is it black? Because that's the color that dries the quickest coming off the assembly line.
And I did not know that. Yeah.
Yeah. And so the whole mindset has been more, you know, more pens, more laptops, more cars. And even in these quote unquote digital worlds, right, say movies, it's still, you know, as many movie tickets as you can. I mean, heck, even professional services, lawyers, accountants, you know, they're basically trying to sell an hour right? And so their product is one person hour, and there's a price on that. And if I could sell as many of those things and bring my cost down, that's how it works. And now fast forward, you know, and so then you build up these big supply chains and distribution chains. So I don't really sell my product directly to the consumer. I give it to the distributor that gives it to the retailer that gives it to the retailer. And eventually at some point on the other side, there's somebody buying the Coca-Cola. There's somebody buying the Ford car, but you don't necessarily know who they are. Mm-hmm. Right. And now with digital technologies, you don't need that anymore. Right. You know, Apple knows how often you're using your iPhone because you're logged into it all the time. Right. Tesla knows how often you're driving your car. Salesforce knows how often you use their software products. Again, the physical products are all going in that world as well. We're talking to furniture manufacturers that are putting a thin layer of electronics so that they can actually know how often you're actually using, you know, your desk at work, right? Because the facilities departments are trying to figure out, well, how much space do we need? Wouldn't it be great if the furniture can just tell us, right, how they're being used? Mm-hmm. And it's all possible. All this is possible today, right? So now if you're building a company that's not taking advantage of that, then some other company is going to. And so you talk about cars. Why are all the cars, you know, we actually, you know, we're a company that sells to subscription companies. We actually have 6 of the top 10 car manufacturers customers. Why is that? Well, it's because of Uber, right? These car companies are realizing, you know, like once I used Uber as a service, my need to own a Ford or a General Motors or a Mercedes or a Toyota becomes less, right? Because my ultimate point is not to own the car. My ultimate point is to get from point A to point B, is to commute to work in the morning and get back home at night, whatever it is, right? If I can use a service to do that, then I'm going to go there. And so Ford, General Motors, these companies are all saying, look, we are still selling as many, you know, lots of cars. We actually do have lots of customers. They're driving our cars every day. But how do we build a digital relationship with these people, right? And then how do we start to migrate them over to think of what they use us for as a service, right? And so we're going to help, we're going to be the company that helps them get to work versus we're going to be the company that sells them a car, you know, every 3 to 5 years.
So we got to talk about this one buzzword that I hear all the time, and you guys touched on it very nicely in the book, digital transformation. So it's probably overused. And if I had to guess, it's very likely misunderstood, maybe like branding. It means something different to everyone. Talk about what digital transformation means to you, particularly as it relates to looking more like a circle.
Well, digital transformation to us, if you simplify it, it's just there's a lot of new technologies out there. And at the core of all this new technology, you can call it AI, you can call it big data, whatever, is the idea that we're all connected. This is all, you know, side effects or second, third, fourth order effects of the internet. We're all connected, and because we're all connected, we can collect a bunch of data, we can manage the data, right, and so on and so forth. And there was a wave of like, okay, how do I use digital technologies not to change what I do, but to make what I do more efficient? I'm going to make my supply chain more efficient. I'm going to make my salespeople more efficient. I'm going to make my call center more efficient, my manufacturing operations more efficient. But that fundamentally didn't change the business. And then you see a wave of companies come about and says, you know, we can actually just change things. And so Netflix says in the early days, right, rather than you walk into Blockbuster, why don't we just send it to you? And you could just go on the website, pick your movies out, and we'll just send it to you. But because they always had that customer orientation, then when technologies improve, they're saying, well, why am I sending the DVD to you? Why don't I just stream the movie directly to you? And why don't I predict what movies you want to see? Why don't I like take all my cash and actually invest in building new movies and new shows that you want to see, right? And so because they take a customer orientation, they can evolve in all these different ways versus being stuck on saying, you know, my job is to sell you DVDs. And all I'm doing is counting how many DVDs I actually sell you. So you talk about a circle. There's a diagram in the book that, you know, what we hear, like, you know, a lot of companies that read the book, they share the book internally, they'll go back to this picture.
Yes.
And on the left is a picture of a, you know, looks like a hierarchy, but it's the idea that you sell a product, you feed the product to as many channels as you can. So let's sell it through the retail stores. Let's sell it online. Let's sell it through our partners. Let's sell it through distributors. And on the other end, there's a bunch of customers, All right. So you're trying to sell this product into as many customers as possible. On the right, it's a circle because you start with the customer. And the customer is spending time in all these different places, right? They're spending time on the phone. They're spending time on their laptop. They're talking to your salespeople. They're in your physical stores. They're on your website, right? They're in your app, whatever it is. And then how do you weave together an experience that delivers them what they're truly looking for, right? Because they're not looking for the DVD. They're looking to be entertained, right? They're not looking for the car. They're looking to get from point A to point B. They're not looking to install your software. They're just trying to do some work. Right. And if you can actually deliver them what they truly want as a service, and you're using, you know, modern technologies, which happen to be digital, if you will, to do that, that can be transformational for your business. And by the way, if you don't do it, you're vulnerable to somebody else coming in way and stealing your customers from you. But if you do it, there's new sources of growth.
Right. And is that, I was wondering if that was related, if you could talk about how in 1975, the life expectancy of a Fortune 500 company was like 75 years. And you say that today you have like 15 years to enjoy your time on the list before it's lights
right.
out. What's happening?
Well, when anybody that sells a product can lose their customers because they get front-ended by a service that steals their customers away, right? Uber front-ends Ford and General Motors, Salesforce front ends SAP, right? These subscription boxes companies are front ending the retailers. You don't need to go to the retailers anymore. We'll just send you the box. You're vulnerable. You're very, very vulnerable. And I'm giving you these consumer examples, right? But in the B2B space, right, companies that sell to other companies, it's the same story, right? And so that's why we're seeing the life expectancy reduce, because consumer habits are changing. You know this because you feel it in your personal lives. Right, it's playing out at a company level as well. And so, if you don't change what you do as a company to meet these customers where they are today and in the future, then it's hard. It's hard to stay in business, and you see declining revenues as a result.
Right, and you mentioned that we've talked about some of these other really well known things, and maybe they're more consumer oriented things. But let's. Instead, for a brief moment here, talk about one of my favorite topics, manufacturing. You have an entire chapter on manufacturing. And it was an interesting story because you write about how in the early days of Zuora, you'd sit around a dinner table with a bottle of wine, maybe two, and try to stump yourselves about
That's right.
what can't be subscribed to. And you go on to explain that the answer was always to tease out the service level agreement that sits behind the product. And so I wanted to ask you to talk about manufacturing and why they stand to benefit perhaps the most from this transformation to a subscription model, and particularly as it relates to the Internet of Things, IoT.
Well, you know, you're starting these companies, right? You're a small company. You work lots of hours. You go out to dinner, maybe open a bottle of wine. And so we used to play this game, and then we would always go to like heavy equipment or like heavy things like cement.
Yeah, cement. Things that people would think, no way. They do a subscription.
Yeah. How do you subscribe to cement? I mean, what does that even mean, right? And then, you know, years later, we're talking to a company that sells floors, and they literally sell floors, like hardwood, tile, cement, floors. And that was fascinating. Right. And it's like, well, you know, here's a company that's doing, or we with tractors. And then years later, we're talking to Caterpillar. And so I remember a few years ago, there was a moment in time where, you know, up till then, we were working primarily with what I'll call digital companies, right?
Sure.
It could be video, music, software, you know, news, right? But things that feel digital. And then we started having all these manufacturing companies, right? Car companies like Ford, right? Industrial equipment like Caterpillar, right? You know, commercial.
Sumitomo, I think, was another you talked about.
Yeah, exactly. You know, Komatsu, Schneider, right? And I mean, consumer things, right? Like Nest, right? The Nest Cam.
Right.
And so we're wondering, like, well, why are we seeing all these manufacturing companies? And the answer was pretty clear. The answer was IoT. That these companies, you know, the cost of putting sensors in your physical products, especially if they're electronic and they're drawing power, had gotten to the point where there's no reason not to do it. And so they had spent, you know, 2, 3, 5 years. And a lot of their, you know, Caterpillar was saying, look, we know we have 2 million assets in the field. At the time, like, we know 200,000 of them are collecting data and sending it into, quote unquote, the cloud, right? They're sending it to some database in the internet. And now I think they're up to like over 1 million. So now all of a sudden, like, we can see, right? We were blind before, Now we can actually see, you know, I'm visualizing. I don't know what it looks like, but I'm visualizing. They could probably see a U.S. map of all these lights and pins of where all their assets are, and they can zoom in to say, okay, this tractor is being used right now, right? And oh, by the way, based on the vibration patterns, we can tell, you know, it probably needs to be serviced. And let's go service it now before it breaks versus it breaks. And now it takes us 2 weeks to get the right parts and the right person to it. And the thing's just out of commission for 2 weeks. And so it's just a transformation in how you think. And now you look at the manufacturing sector and you say, gosh, this industry has been under a decline for 30 to 40 years. But Caterpillar is saying, well, we can see these vast new revenue streams, right? Now that we have full control over these things, we have ideas of doing predictive maintenance applications. We have ideas of doing safety applications. There's all these things that we can do. You know, we know it's possible that we can just run this whole thing as an autonomous system, and our customers just pay us based on metric tons of earth moved, right? Versus, yeah, and so it's all possible today.
And what they really want is they want the earth moved.
Right. Oh, I don't want to own a tractor, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure somebody out there does, right? But most of us just want, you know, the whole has a purpose. But on top of that, what the engineers are suddenly realizing is because they spent all this time building these incredible, complex, sophisticated equipment, and then they give it to their customers, and they're staring in horror about how badly their customers are using their equipment. And they're saying, man, I can do this better than you. And so we were talking to a printing company in Europe that sells these million-dollar printers, right? And they sell to print shops. Then they sell like local things, like you want to print flyers or magazines.
Oh,
or,
Heidelberg, I think you said it was.
Heidelberg, exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, you know, our engineers design these products. They know how to use these products the best. So if I can actually, you know, run this printer for you, I can actually run it at a higher capacity than you could, right? Because I'm more sophisticated. I mean, I designed the damn thing, right? And you will make more money off of that, right? Because you're making money based on the use of this equipment. And so this is the story of GE with their turbines. This is the story of Caterpillar with their tractors. And so the manufacturing, we believe, sector is going to have a renaissance once their products, you know, evolve into services. And because there's so much more value to unlock in these sectors when the designers of the physical products can actually use them and service them and run them in ways that are far better and far more efficient than their customers could.
Mm, yes. So in the book, you talk about wide-ranging topics about how a company gets changed in terms of finance and IT. And I think you said that even the investment world, there's still a lot of people that still don't understand the finances behind the subscription model. You'll probably always have to be explaining that. And you even walk through how, I think it was Adobe, was one of the first ones that, as you say, swallowed the fish, where they moved from the shipping the software to more of a subscriber-based one. And I got the impression that it started to get a little bit easier for some of the other companies after that. But this is the Marketing Book Podcast, so let's talk a little bit more about marketing. In the book, you talk about how there's never been a more exciting time to be in marketing, and also how a subscription model approach makes your marketing quite different from shipping the product. What are some of the different ways that marketing has to work in a subscription model, and some of the benefits as well?
Yeah. So you're actually, the first half of the book was really to show people how the subscription model transforms industries, right? A lot of people have a naive view that subscription means keep the product the way it is, but just rent it out over time. And that doesn't quite get at the essence of it, right? There's a whole transformation that happens to a company, to an industry, when they take a customer first orientation. And we look at retail, we look at manufacturing, we look at software.
And journalism. There were several examples we won't have time to talk about, but I was very encouraged to see that there's a future for journalism, because I was, you know, it's declined because of the decline of advertising, but a democracy needs strong and vibrant journalism. Yeah.
We could do a whole hour on just newspapers alone.
Yeah.
We're really bullish on it. And then the second half book talks about how it changes different departments. And you drill into marketing. I'll share a story that's not quite in the book. But when we engaged with a company where the marketing department just launched a loyalty program, that tells us that they haven't quite shifted their thinking yet, right? And so you imagine marketing is being tasked that says, look, we want to drive up revenue, get closer to the customers. And they're saying, well, look, I can't really change the product. I can't change the price. I can't change how we sell. Right. And, but I know my product has repeat purchases from the customer. How do I make sure the repeat purchases come to me and not to my competitor? Got loyalty, right? You know, I'll give them a discount if they buy more from me, right? So some kind of stars, right? Some kind of discount, some kind of loyalty card, right?
Punch the bagel card.
Punch the bagel card, right? And usually that happens when marketing is restricted from it. But when you tear down the silos and you can start saying, you know what? This is not about punching the bagel card. This is about, right, you give me $20 a month and you can walk in any time and get whatever bagel you want, right? Or something like that, right? Mm-hmm. Whatever the service happens to be. Now the walls have fallen. And now marketing says, gosh, I'm like a kid in a candy store. I can reinvent my business because I'm the one that, you know, that's closest to the customer. We're the ones doing the service. Well, first of all, I get all this information about the customer that I never had before, right? And so one of the stories we told in the book is Gray's, right? And Gray's is somebody that sends you a box of snacks, like popcorn, nuts, every single week. And then they follow up with an email that says, which snacks did you like? And the CEO of the company was telling me a story. He used to come from a CPG company, a consumer products good company. I think it was Energy Drinks. And they would do all this market research when they wanted to go into a new region, right? And you know, what product is going to work? We need to know. And we're going to do that through millions of dollars of market research. And now he's got this new company where he's just collecting information from the customers directly. And he says, I didn't spend a dime. And he was a UK company. He took his UK inventory, dumped it into the US, right?
I think he said he just started shipping it.
He just started shipping it. And then asking the Americans, well, what did you like?
And well, I didn't like the Marmite.
I didn't like the Marmite. Yeah, I didn't like.
But he figured that out pretty quickly.
I didn't like the Vegemite. I didn't like the chutney, right? But give me some more barbecue, right? You know? And so the Americans have, you know, I don't know, the salt and vinegar stuff. Like, what is that? You know, but I'll get some jalapeno. And so the system just self-adjusts because your customers are giving you all this data. So now you're a marketing department. You have real-time information from all your customers. I mean, it's an amazing situation, and you get to drive it. And so, you know, marketing department says, look, I understand the brand of my company. I understand the value proposition. I understand the emotion that I want to connect my customers with. But in the previous world, I can only do any of that stuff through a Super Bowl ad. And now I can actually take all the stuff that I know and build it into the product. I could be designing the entire customer experience to match what my brand aspirations are. And so it's a completely different world, but it's a much more tangible world, and it's a much more rewarding world to be in marketing, being tasked with creating or delivering that brand promise to the customers.
It brought to mind for me the idea of real-time heat-seeking missiles, because it just keeps iterating and getting closer and closer to, you know, customer insight nirvana.
It's a good metaphor. That's a good metaphor. Well,
feel free to steal it.
That's right. The heat-seeking missile.
Right. There's also the issue that I've seen, read about, called the HIPPO, the highest paid person's opinion in the room, where you're able to avoid all that and say, well, this is what the data is telling us. This is what they're using it. You know, our customers are not stupid. This is what they think they're supposed to be doing, or this is what they clearly want. And you're able to make much more nimble decisions. You know, and related to that, talk about the importance of the concept of what you say, staying in beta forever. There was a funny story about Gmail, I think. They introduced Gmail and they left beta on their logo for like 5 years. They just thought, well, of course, we're always in beta. And then finally they had to take it off because some of the enterprise folks said, well, we're not going to buy beta products. But I mean, Netflix has no more pilots, or Kanye West's latest album. Explain this concept, because I think it's frightening for a lot of companies, I would guess, but it's also seems really liberating.
Well, if you think about a service, right, and we could think about the pure services, we can go back a couple hundred years and say, you know, you live in a small town, you go to the butcher, the baker, there's a, you know the person on the other side, and it's a one-on-one relationship that's built on repeat interactions, an element of trust, right, an element of reputation. And that's the way things naturally work. But when you layer on this multi-layer tier distribution channel over a product that doesn't change, because it's all about unit costs, you've broken a lot of that. And the subscription economy gives you a chance really to bring that back. And so, and at scale too. And so you imagine now, you know, instead of being forced to get that product perfect up front and only having one shot to launch it into the marketplace, right? Imagine that, that I can work with, you know, all of my different customers and then iterate just based on their feedback, right? Did you like this? Did you not like this? Should I do more of that? Should I do less of that? And it's just a much more powerful way to build a product or build a service. We saw this at Salesforce.com early on, right, through my story. You know, Gmail obviously was doing this. Software companies have learned, you know, to use this word beta to describe a phase where they're collecting information from beta customers before they freeze the product. But in with digital technologies today, you never have to freeze your product.
Yeah.
Right. And so why not always be in this state? And we love the Gmail story because, yeah, they figured they would just launch in a beta state. And 5 years later, it was still beta.
Well, in their minds, they were still in beta. They always will be.
Yeah, they will always still be. Right. But right. That's just the normal operating procedure. But the word beta carried around this funny thing where, yeah, the enterprise, the procurement departments of these Fortune 500 companies, which, yeah, we can't pay for beta software. And so they took it off. But what I loved about that story was there's a hidden feature like buried in. And so if you're fond of the beta logo, you could put it back.
Right.
So it really didn't mean anything, right? It was just a logo.
Yeah, it was just like their way of saying, fine, you want it off the logo, fine, there. But if
right.
they didn't, they said, you know what, we're going to make these procurement people happy, fine, we'll move that's it right. off of there. But we're not spiritually ever going to leave beta. One thing I wanted to do for the listener is, as I often try to, which is frighten them. And you say that if you're still selling products off shelves to strangers in 5 years, there's a good chance you're not going to make it to 10.
Yeah, we really believe that.
Any product?
Any product. Any product. The amount of innovation that we're seeing with all sorts of companies, right? Because what we're basically saying is, stop treating your customers as anonymous people and get to know who they are, right? And what company doesn't have customers? Obviously, every company has customers, but view them as a subscriber to what you're doing. And the reason that you, the power of the word customer versus subscriber is, you know, a customer is just a name, address, phone number on an order form, right? It's where you ship your product to. As a subscriber is someone who you know, and you want them to come back, right? You want them to come back and use your service on an ongoing basis. And you have not a one-time obligation, oh, I shipped you a product, I fulfilled my obligation, but you have an obligation to meet their needs on an ongoing basis, all right? Again, if you don't do that, somebody else will. Somebody else will go and figure out how to do something for your customer in a way where you're just not needed anymore.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to our manufacturing friends who would say, well, we sell through channels. And so we're selling through like a distributor or rep firms or own, you know, whatever their distribution channels are. We're not selling to the end user. Could you talk about, I can't remember which company it was, but where was maybe it was Autodesk, I think, where
it was, yeah.
They had a channel, a magnificent channel program, still do. It just seems like that would just terrify your channel partners where you say, we're now going to, in a certain way, go direct to the consumers. What talk about what they did and how this can actually happen. I think there's a lot of people, you probably deal with them every day, who are sort of dismissive, but I think this is a very instructive story.
Well, we do get a lot of questions about that from companies, right? Because the whole idea, if I go direct to the consumer, am I bypassing my channel? And today, 80, 90, 100% of my sales are through the channel. And I don't know how to migrate that. And what we loved about the story of Autodesk is Autodesk sells a lot through their channels today, and they didn't cut the channel out. And I think this is a lesson for car companies that sell through dealerships, right? Industrial equipment companies sell through dealers, and even CPG companies that sell, you know, through retailers. Mm-hmm. And what Adobe said is, look, we're a software product. We do see what our customers are doing. We love that part of the system. But rather than teach our own salespeople or our own customer support people, let's teach the channel. And so they signal this to their resellers. They set up a multi-year process where they said, well, let's define a one-year relationship, a repeated one-year relationship. And they went to their partners and said, well, like, sell them, if you're still selling perpetual software, right, the old software model, at least sell a maintenance contract, because now you have a one-year anchor. And we're going to push you all this data. We're going to define what we think you should be doing with the customer in the first 3 months of that year, you know, the middle 6 months, and the last 3 months. I think they called it onboarding, optimization, and then renewal or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then we're going to push you all this data. And we're going to tell you based on what we see with all customers, right, what this customer needs. And so it looks like this customer can really use help, some help in this area. They're not really onboarded correctly. Make sure they're doing that, right? Here's some things that you can do to continue to engage with the customer during that middle 6 months. And now that you're up for renewal, here's ways of thinking about, right, what else can you be doing with the customer that would add more value to them and they would actually be willing to pay more for these services. So we're going to use all the data that we have as a central service, right? Again, Caterpillar has this data now. Ford has this data now. The Wall Street Journal has this data now. HBO has this data now, right? To basically, you know, understand what the customer engagement model should be and then teach our dealers, our resellers, right? Our OEM partners, whatever it is, right? How to basically maximize their customer engagement. So they continue. So it's a co-ownership of the customer. You still own the day-to-day customer relationship, but we can be the master control function, if you will, that helps you optimize what you're doing as part of that relationship.
And I wondered if the resellers, their first visceral reaction might have been, no, I own that relationship. And it seems like the reaction, you know, the answer would be, well, you still will, but we're going to help you deepen that relationship.
Well, imagine, you know, you're a car company now and you're a dealer, right? And what if the car company, you know, what if you're like Tesla and the cars are connected to the internet? You know, you can actually collect information about when they should be serviced, right? And there's a massive thing that says, you know, look, I'll help you automatically, you know, make it really easy for the customer to book an appointment, to reserve a car while the car is in the service center, right? And just make it transparent and super easy for them. Because that's the obstacle for me of bringing my car in, right? And by the way, by doing that, I will drive more customer interactions, and I will drive more servicing, I'll drive more revenue to you. Right. And it's a win-win-win situation.
Mm-hmm. So, Teen, what are some of the biggest obstacles that you've seen for companies that want to become more customer-centric and, you know, possibly go towards more of a subscription model? I just have a sinking feeling that there's a lot of lip service being paid to companies that say they want to become more customer-centric. But for those that have been able to, what are some of the obstacles that they've faced, and what are some of the ways that they've actually been able to dial in more to their customers?
What we see is there's probably three traps, right? We see these days, I think a lot of companies get the change. A lot of executives are hearing this from their customers, their peers, right? And other folks in their industry. And so they sense that a change is needed. And they'll start different initiatives. And I would say that the traps that we see, you know, one is functional silos wind up clogging things up, right? And so how do you help that? And you do you do a corporate initiative? Do you create a side, you know, digital unit, if you will, right? And some of these digital units have been very successful, right? Let's start a digital unit. Let's get that successful. And then we'll roll it back into the core company at some point in the future. But some
when
way
you say, excuse me, when you say bottlenecks with departments, what would be an example? Are we talking like turf wars?
Well, it's turned out, right, that in order to scale in the last century, these companies, right, again, business school teaches us to do these things. We've built stovepipe organizations. So sales is a department and they sit in that building.
Right.
Marketing is a department and they stay in this building. And then the metrics that we measure these departments are isolated. We minimize the amount of interaction each department has to have with the others, right? It's controlled, it's minimized because our goal is to scale up. Mm-hmm. Right. And that doesn't work anymore. Right. And how do you iterate? How do you want to change the product and change the marketing and change the pricing and change how you sell as a complete solution? Right. It's not just a tweak to your existing way of doing products.
Okay.
And so some companies that are, you know, more subscriptions and more digital do a big bang approach. And other companies say Caterpillar says, look, we're not going to change how we sell tractors, but we're going to start taking advantage of the fact that there's smart tractors connected to the internet. To launch some digital offerings in a digital unit, if you will. And, you know, there's no right or wrong answer. It really depends on the company. Both can work. But the key is to to really make sure that you're doing in such a way that you're bringing cross-functional teams together, right? And they can come together with an overall plan. Mm-hmm. The second thing that we see is a lack of iteration. There's still a mindset that says, I'll do it once, right? It's that always be in beta mindset. They're not mm-hmm. really like that, right? They still are stuck on their 2-year product life cycles where I'll do all this work, I'll launch it, and then I kind of move on to my next product, right? And that's still embedded in a lot of companies' thinking. And so we've seen a company that sells a smart toothbrush. And this company is committed to figuring this out. You know, hats off to them. And the toothbrush basically teaches you how to brush your teeth. It's a smart toothbrush through like GPS, accelerometers, even a mirror. It can say, you know what? There's a whole part of your mouth that you're actually not doing a good job brushing. And it should be a service because it's a technology. It's got some AI in it. But then what they realized was, you know what? This is not a repeated interaction. Like once I'm taught how to brush my teeth, like I change my habits, I don't really use the service over and over again. And so they're like, okay, well, that was really, really interesting. We learned a lot about our customers, right? But from a recurring nature, right? And they're in personal health, hair removal. That actually is an ongoing repetitive thing.
Oh, okay.
Right? Yeah. And so they're switching their attention to that. And of course, with the toothbrush, it's sending out a new toothbrush head, right? Because these are the electronic toothbrushes.
Right.
Electric toothbrushes, you know, on a regular basis. And that is a repeated interaction. And so you see a company that's willing to like, you know, launch something, learn, right, iterate and be committed to it. But the key thing is, are you learning more and more about your customers and are you iterating with them?
Mm.
The trap that people fall into, probably not exactly a third one, is I don't change my product. I just rent it out. And so I think some of the early car subscription services that you see the car companies do.
Which I did not know about until I read your book. I did not know you could subscribe to a car. And it is different from a lease.
It is different from a lease, right? So Cadillac had a service that says you can you know, pay, I forget what it is, like $7.99, $9.99, something like that, a month. And you subscribe to the car. When you don't want it, you can bring it back.
You can have like 12 cars a year.
Yeah, you could swap it, right? And to a different car, right? Because my needs change. And that's not bad. It's a good learning exercise, but it didn't fundamentally change the economic model. And it didn't really deliver what the customer really wants, right? Which is to get from point A to point B. It didn't really transform. So I thought it was a good learning exercise.
Okay.
Right. But I'm not sure that is the long-term thing that will be the winner for the car companies.
Okay. All right. Well, Tien, if listeners took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
We try to boil it down. And that diagram certainly helps. And we try to boil it down to two words, right? Product versus customer. This whole thing is really about starting with the customer, viewing them as subscribers, right? We talked to, you know, both startups, disruptors, if you will, and we talked to big companies. And the message for bigger companies is not, you know, doom and gloom. It's not like you will be disrupted by Uber. You will be disrupted by Airbnb. The picture is actually much more complex. If the goal is about turning customers into subscribers, and you already have the most customers, right? Coca-Cola has a lot of customers. Nike has a lot of customers. Walmart has a lot of customers. The problem is they just don't know who they are, right? Mm-hmm. You know, Nike doesn't know who you don't have a Nike ID. You have an Amazon ID. And you use an Amazon ID to walk into an Amazon Go store, pick up a few, you know, bags of chips and walk out. And Amazon knows you did that, you know, because it's tied to your Amazon ID. You go to Foot Locker, buy some Nike sneakers. Nike doesn't know who you are. Nike doesn't know how often you're using your sneakers. Nike doesn't know when's the next time you should buy. Nike doesn't know what your favorite sports are, when your exercise habit, but they have the ability to know all this stuff, right? But so the question for these big companies is, can they reinvent how they think and start with a customer and not view what they do as selling sneakers, selling cars, selling bags of chips, right? And if they can do that, they've got an amazing future.
And, you know, product versus customer could be one of the things I could carve in stone after over 200 of these episodes. If companies just think more about their customers and how they can help their customers, I know this is really easy to say, but it's very hard for companies to get past being in the product business instead of in the customer business.
That's right.
What books have inspired your work and career?
Well, I'll tell you, I mean, I certainly read a lot of business books, but when we wrote Subscribed, and I appreciate all the comments that you gave earlier on the show, Malcolm Gladwell was our mental model.
Mm.
And, you know, I believe that we live in a world now that's a little bit more driven by storytelling, right? And the human nature to share and propagate stories is how we all learn.
Yes.
And you're seeing that amplified on a large scale because of social networks and so on and so forth, right? For positive and for negative, right? And so what we tried, you know, so the books that I love reading is Malcolm Gladwell because he's got such a powerful storytelling capability. And you're always learning something new, right? You're always learning something new. It's like, I didn't know that. I didn't know that the 100,000 hours thing or the 150 person, you know, in your network, all these little Malcolm Gladwellisms. And now he's got a podcast, he's got TV shows. And so whenever, you know, he writes something, it's always a treat to go back and then, you know, learn about something new, but also be inspired by the techniques of storytelling that he does so well.
You know, I think he could write about almost anything and you would enjoy reading it.
He could write about paint drying and you would be sucked right into it.
Oh, absolutely. And seriously, there were some topics in your book that, and we get books here now every day for all these nice authors that are asking to be on the podcast. And occasionally I'll look at one and I'll just think, oh, this is going to be torture to read. and I'll pass on it. And then in your book, you all were talking about IT departments and financial models and all that sort of thing.
Income statements.
Yeah. Income statements, yeah. And back to our earlier joke, you even explained...
Double entry bookkeeping.
And at the bottom of the paragraph, you said, there, I just saved you $100,000 on an MBA.
That's right.
You're going to get a call from the Stanford Graduate School of Business, I think.
They're doing fine.
Right. Yeah. Yes.
Producing more authors.
That's right. So when you go and speak to them once a year, I'm going to send you a stack of Marketing Book Podcast bookmarks. Just go ahead and hand them out to the students because they're all going to be on the show. So
that's right.
That's great.
We'll slot it for you for the next 5 years.
There you go. So are there any recent or upcoming books that you recommend or are looking forward to reading?
You know, I try to read a lot of fiction these days, just, you know, running a public company and all that. It's good to take a break and get some perspective.
That's great advice. It's very good for your brain, too.
Yeah. But I'll tell you, the thing on the back of my mind, strangely enough, I'm being on a show, is actually to listen to more podcasts. I think there's a rising tide of podcasts. And I do feel like it's a wealth of information. It's something that I want to be doing more of.
Oh, terrific. Well, now, just out of curiosity, because I know Guy Kawasaki talked about how he loves reading, like, Lee Child, you know, that fiction. What are some of the fiction you like?
Oh, gosh, I got a stack of books. It's pretty eclectic. I wound up getting recommendations. I'll tell you, the one I just finished reading was a trilogy, and it's called The Three-Body Problem. And it's an interesting thing. It's a Chinese author, so I read it translated into English, but it spans 800 years, wow. And it's got some far out stuff. It's got string theory. It's got all these crazy things in it. It reminds me of probably books from Arthur C. Clarke, from before.
Oh, true.
And but you know, it just puts your mind into, like, you know, you're running your business, you're building this thing, you're trying to figure out the subscription economy, and then these authors take you to, like, a whole different place.
right. But that's why the ideas come to you while you're in the shower or while you're on the exercise machine. You're thinking in a sort of a parallel way instead of about the specific challenge at hand. So how best can listeners learn more about you and the book?
Well, the best way, really, so we have a whole site dedicated to the subscription economy. The book is called Subscribe. The site's called Subscribe. We actually have events around the world as well.
The conference. And
so go to conferences, right? So go to www.subscribe.com. And if you are, you know, an IT professional or a finance executive looking for software that can help you do all this, the company is Zuora, Zuora.com. But feel free to follow me on Twitter, TIENTZUO.
Okay, super. Well, we'll include links to the sites, your LinkedIn profile, Twitter handle, and all the books that we've mentioned. We're going to have to find that other book. And I'm also going to include a picture of that visual of the circle. Sure. Versus the more command and control approach, because that is, in fact, the most important visual in the entire book. We'll include a link to that and your episode show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And for you, dear listener, if you're listening on your smartphone and you've subscribed to the Marketing Book Podcast, Did you hear that? I said subscribed. On iTunes or your favorite podcast app, there's a bunch of them out there. All these links can be found by going to this episode on your podcast player and clicking on the show notes link. The name of the book is Subscribed, Why the Subscription Model Will Be Your Company's Future and What to Do About It. The authors are Tien Zuo and Gabe Weisert. Tien, thank you very much for joining us on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Of course, my pleasure.
And that closes the book on episode 219 of the Marketing Book Podcast. For more, check out this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And if I can recommend a specific marketing or sales book or other helpful resource for whatever situation you find yourself in, feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn where we can chat and I'll try to point you in the right direction. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Special thanks to our sponsor, Blinkist. To support the Marketing Book Podcast and start your free Blinkist trial or get 20% off your yearly plan, visit Blinkist.com/marketingbookpodcast or just click on the link at marketingbookpodcast.com. And please join us next time as we welcome Steve Woodruff to the Marketing Book Podcast to talk about his new book, Clarity Wins. Get heard, get referred. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast. This episode was produced by Sean Armstrong. I am absolutely sincere. This was such a joy to read. It really was. Congratulations to you and Gabe.
Good. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
All righty. Well, take care. Now back to work, I guess, huh?
All right.
Take
Thanks,
care.
Doug. Thanks
bye-bye.
For the break.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.